Chapter 33. Cross the sea and change the air? I have my own opinion. Hobbit, Rolando, thou wert a most kind and hospitable bandit, and I love not to think of thee with a chain at thy shin. Do you know how all these memories of unfortunate men have come upon me? When they came to frighten me this morning, by speaking of my robbed pears, my perforated garden wall, I was reading an article in the Saturday Review about Rupilius. I have sat near that young man at a public dinner, and beheld him in a gilded uniform. But yesterday he lived in splendor, had long hair, a flowing beard, a jewel at his neck, and a smart surtout. So attired, he stood but yesterday in court, and today he sits over a bowl of prison cocoa, with a shaved head, and in a felon's jerkin. That beard and head shaved, that gaudy deputy lieutenant's coat exchanged for felon uniform, and your daily bottle of champagne for prison cocoa, my poor Rupilius, what a comfort it must be, to have the business brought to an end. Champagne was the honorable gentleman's drink in the House of Commons dining room, as I am informed. What uncommonly dry champagne, that must have been. When we saw him outwardly happy, how miserable he must have been. When we thought him prosperous, how dismally poor. When the great Mr. Harker, at the public dinners, called out, "Gentlemen, charge your glasses, and please silence for the honorable member for Lambeth," how that honorable member must have writhed inwardly. One day, when there was a talk of a gentleman's honor being questioned, Rupilius said, "If any man doubted mine, I would knock him down." But that speech was in the way of business. The Spartan boy, who stole the fox, smiled while the beast was gnawing him under his cloak. I promise you Rupilius had some sharp fangs gnashing under his. We have sat at the same feast, I say. We have paid our contribution to the same charity. Ah! When I ask this day for my daily bread, I pray not to be led into temptation, and to be delivered from evil. Desains. I arrived by the night mail packet from Dover. The passage had been rough, and the usual consequences had ensued. I was disinclined to travel farther that night on my road to Paris, and knew the Calais Hotel of old as one of the cleanest, one of the dearest, one of the most comfortable hotels on the continent of Europe. There is no town more French than Calais. That charming old Hôtel d'Essene, with its court, its gardens, its lordly kitchen, its princely waiter, a gentleman of the old school, who has welcomed the finest company in Europe, have long been known to me. I have read complaints in the Times, more than once, I think, that the d'Essene bills are dear. A bottle of soda water certainly costs well, never mind how much. I remember as a boy, at the hip at Dover imprint Carolo Decimo, when, my place to London being paid, I had but 12s. Left after a certain little Paris excursion, about which my benighted parents never knew anything, ordering for dinner a whiting, a beefsteak, and a glass of negus, and the bill was, dinner 7s, glass of negus 2s, waiter 60, and only half a crown left, as I was a sinner, for the guard and coachman on the way to London. And I was a sinner. I had gone without leave. What a long, dreary, guilty 40 hours journey it was from Paris to Calais, I remember. How did I come to think of this escapade, which occurred in the Easter vacation of the year 1830? I always think of it when I am crossing to Calais. Guilt, sir, guilt remains stamped on the memory, and I feel easier in my mind now that it is liberated of this old peccadillo. I met my college tutor only yesterday. We were traveling, and stopped at the same hotel. He had the very next room to mine. After he had gone into his apartment, having shaken me quite kindly by the hand, I felt inclined to knock at his door and say, "Dr. Bentley, I beg your pardon, but do you remember, when I was going down at the Easter vacation in 1830 you asked me where I was going to spend my vacation? And I said, with my friend Slingsby, in Huntingdonshire. Well, sir, I grieve to have to confess that I told you a fib. I had got 20L. and was going for a lark to Paris, where my friend Edwards was staying. There, it is out. The doctor will read it, for I did not wake him up after all to make my confession, but protest he shall have a copy of this roundabout sent to him when he returns to his lodge. They gave me a bedroom there, a very neat room on the first floor, looking into the pretty garden. The hotel must look pretty much as it did 100 years ago when he visited it. I wonder whether he paid his bill? Yes. His journey was just begun. He had borrowed, or got the money somehow. Such a man would spend it liberally enough when he had it, give generously nay, drop a tear over the fate of the poor fellow whom he relieved. I don't believe a word he says, but I never accused him of stinginess about money. That is a fault of much more virtuous people than he. Mr. Lawrence is ready enough with his purse, when there are anybody's guineas in it. Still, when I went to bed in the room, in his room, when I think how I admire, dislike, and have abused him, a certain dim feeling of apprehension filled my mind at the midnight hour. What if I should see his lean figure in the black satin breeches, his sinister smile, his long thin finger pointing to me in the moonlight, for I am in bed, and have popped my candle out, and he should say, "You mistrust me, you hate me, do you? And you, don't you know how Jack, Tom, and Harry, your brother authors, hate you?" I grin and laugh in the moonlight, in the midnight, in the silence. You ghost in black satin breeches and a wig. I like to be hated by some men, I say. No men whose lives are a scheme, whose laughter is a conspiracy, whose smile means something else, whose hatred is a cloak, and I had rather these men should hate me than not. "My good sir," says he, with a ghastly grin on his lean face, "you have your wish." "Appers?" I say. "Please let me go to sleep. I shan't sleep any the worse, because there are insects in the bed, and they sting you." This is only by way of illustration, my good sir. The animals don't bite me now. All the house at present seems to me excellently clean. 'Tis absurd to affect this indifference. If you are thin-skinned, and the reptiles bite, they keep you from sleep. There are some men who cry out at a flea bite as loud as if they were torn by a vulture, I growl. Men of the genus Irritabile, my worthy good gentleman. And you are one. Yes, sir, I am of the profession, as you say, and I dare say make a great shouting and crying at a small hurt. You are ashamed of that quality by which you earn your subsistence, and such reputation as you have? Your sensibility is your livelihood, my worthy friend. You feel a pang of pleasure or pain. It is noted in your memory, and some day or other makes its appearance in your manuscript. Why, in your last roundabout rubbish you mention reading your first novel on the day when King George IV was crowned. I remember him in his cradle at St. James, a lovely little babe. A gilt Chinese railing was before him, and I dropped the tear of sensibility as I gazed on the sleeping cherub. "A tear, a fiddlestick, Mr. Stern," I growled out, for of course I knew my friend in the wig and satin breeches to be no other than the notorious, nay, celebrated Mr. Lawrence Stern. "Does not the sight of a beautiful infant charm and melt you, mon ami? If not, I pity you." Yes, he was beautiful. I was in London the year he was born. I used to breakfast at the Mount Coffee House. I did not become the fashion until 2 years later, when my Tristram made his appearance, who has held his own for 100 years. By the way, mon bon monsieur, how many authors of your present time will last till the next century? Do you think Brown will? I laughed with scorn as I lay in my bed,
and so did the ghost give a ghastly snigger.
"Brown!" I roared. "Knee of the most overrated men that ever put pen to paper. What do you think of Jones?" I grew indignant with this old cynic. "Essay reasonable ghost, come out of the other world, you don't mean," I said, "to ask me a serious opinion of Mr. Jones? His books may be very good reading for maid servants and schoolboys, but you don't ask me to read them? As a scholar yourself, you must know that." "Well then, Robinson?"
Robinson, I am told, has merit. I dare say, I never have been able to read his books, and can't, therefore, form any opinion about Mr. Robinson. At least you will allow that I am not speaking in a prejudiced manner about him. Ah, I see you men of letters have your cabals and jealousies, as we had in my time. There was an Irish fellow by the name of Goldsmith, who used to abuse me, but he went into no genteel company and faith, it mattered little, his praise or abuse. I never was more surprised than when I heard that Mr. Irving, an American gentleman of parts and elegance, had wrote the fellow's life. To make a hero of that man, my dear sir, 'twas ridiculous. You followed in the fashion, I hear, and chose to lay a wreath before this queer little idol. Preposterous. A pretty writer, who has turned some neat couplets. Bah! I have no patience with master posterity that has chosen to take up this fellow and make a hero of him. And there was another gentleman of my time, Mr. Thiefcatcher Fielding, forsooth. A fellow with the strength, and the tastes, and the manners of a porter. What madness has possessed you all to bow before that Calvert butt of a man? A creature without elegance or sensibility. The dog had spirits, certainly. I remember my Lord Bathurst praising them. But as for reading his books, ma foi, I would as lief go and dive for tripe in a cellar. The man's vulgarity stifles me. He wafts me whiffs of gin. Tobacco and onions are in his great coarse laugh, which choke me, party, and I don't think much better of the other fellow, the Scots Gallipot Purveyor Peregrine Clinker, Humphrey Random. How did the fellow call his rubbish? Neither of these men, at the Bel Air, the Bon Ton, the Genie's Case Quoy. Pa! If I meet them in my walks by our Stygian River, I give them a wide berth, as that hybrid apothecary fellow would say. An ounce of civet, good apothecary. Horrible, horrible. The mere thought of the coarseness of those men gives me the chair de Powell. Mr. Fielding, especially, has no more sensibility than a butcher in Fleet Market. He takes his heroes out of alehouse kitchens, or worse places still. And this is the person whom posterity has chosen to honor along with me. Faith, Monsieur Posterity, you have put me in pretty company, and I see you are no wiser than we were in our time. Mr. Fielding, forsooth. Mr. Tripe and Onions. Mr. Cowheel and Gin. Thank you for nothing, Monsieur Posterity. And so, thought I, even among these Stygians this envy and quarrelsomeness, if you will permit me the word, survive? What a pitiful meanness. To be sure, I can understand this feeling to a certain extent, a sense of justice will prompt it. In my own case, I often feel myself forced to protest against the absurd praises lavished on contemporaries. Yesterday, for instance, Lady Jones was good enough to praise one of my works, Trespine. But in the very next minute she began, with quite as great enthusiasm, to praise Miss Hobson's last romance. My good creature, what is that woman's praise worth who absolutely admires the writings of Miss Hobson? I offer a friend a bottle of 44 claret, fit for a pontifical supper. This is capital wine, apostrophe says he. And now we have finished the bottle, will you give me a bottle of that ordinaire we drank the other day? Apostrophe apostrophe very well, my good man. You are a good judge of ordinaire, I dare say. Nothing so provokes my anger, and rouses my sense of justice, as to hear other men undeservedly praised. In a word, if you wish to remain friends with me, don't praise anybody. You tell me that the Venus de Medici is beautiful, or Jacob Omnium is tall. Que diable! Can't I judge for myself? Haven't I eyes, and a foot rule? I don't think the Venus is so handsome, since you press me. She is pretty, but she has no expression. And as for Mr. Omnium, I can see much taller men in a fair for twopence. And so, I said, turning round to Mr. Stern, you are actually jealous of Mr. Fielding? Oh, you men of letters, you men of letters! Is not the world, your world, I mean, big enough for all of you? I often travel in my sleep. I often of a night find myself walking in my nightgown about the gray streets. It is awkward at first, but somehow nobody makes any remark. I glide along over the ground with my naked feet. The mud does not wet them. The passers-by do not tread on them. I am wafted over the ground, down the stairs, through the doors. This sort of traveling, dear friends, I am sure you have all of you indulged. Well, on the night in question, and, if you wish to know the precise date, it was the 31st of September last, after having some little conversation with Mr. Stern in our bedroom, I must have got up, though I protest I don't know how, and come downstairs with him into the coffee room of the Hotel des Seines, where the moon was shining, and a cold supper was laid out. I forget what we had volo venti ufstofenix agno ox pistaches a la barmicide. What matters what we had. As regards supper, this is certain, the less you have of it the better. That is what one of the guests remarked, a shabby old man, in a wig, and such a dirty, ragged, disreputable dressing gown, that I should have been quite surprised at him. Only one never is surprised in DR under certain circumstances. I can't eat 'em now, said the greasy man with his false old teeth. I wonder he could eat anything. Remember Alvin Lee eating three suppers once at Carlton House one night, the petite comite. Petite comite, sir, said Mr. Stern. Dammy, sir, let me tell my own story my own way. I say, one night at Carlton House, playing at blind hooky with York Wales, Tom Rakes, Prince Boothby, and Dutch Sam the Boxer, Alvin Lee ate three suppers, and won 23,000 pounds in ponies. Never saw a fellow with such an appetite, except Wales in his good time. But he destroyed the finest digestion a man ever had with maraschino, by Jove always at it. Try mine, said Mr. Stern. What a deuced queer box, says Mr. Brummel. I had it from a capucha friar in this town. The box is but a horn one, but to the nose of sensibility Araby's perfume is not more delicate. I call it deuced stale old rapee, says Mr. Brummel. As for me, I declare I could not smell anything at all in either of the boxes. Old boy in smock frock, take a pinch. The old boy in the smock frock, as Mr. Brummel called him, was a very old man, with long white beard, wearing, not a smock frock, but a shirt. And he had actually nothing else save a rope round his neck, which hung behind his chair in the queerest way. Fair sir, he said, turning to Mr. Brummel, when the Prince of Wales and his father laid siege to our town, what nonsense are you talking, old cock? Says Mr. Brummel, Wales was never here. His late Majesty George IV passed through on his way to Hanover. My good man, you don't seem to know what's up at all. What is he talking about the siege of Calais? I lived here 15 years. Ought to know. What's his old name? I am Master Eustace of St. Peter's, said the old gentleman in the shirt. And my lord King Edward laid siege to this city, laid siege to Jericho, cries Mr. Brummel. He old man is cracked, sir. Laid siege to this city, continued the old man, I and five more. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.